I'm going to talk a little bit, just give an update about some of the disease resistance breeding in Hydrangea macrophylla. It's one of the most economically important nursery crops, especially in our area in Middle Tennessee and the surrounding counties. In 2014, sales of all hydrangea species topped 120 million, which were up from 90 million in the 2007 horticultural census. So quite a big surge in popularity and purchasing. There are over 1,200 varieties described now, and new ones are added yearly, possibly monthly, maybe daily. But they're mostly primarily bred by breeding companies, hobbyists for floral characteristics, maybe foliar characteristics, but there's limited breeding for sort of long-term breeding projects for resistance to pests, disease, drought, traits like that. We are interested in those traits because they would significantly reduce the environmental and budgetary footprint associated with hydrangea production. And in USDA ARS, we are dedicated to supporting the growers in that way with grower-friendly varieties that help growers, that help their business, that help the environmental health and safety of their workers. So there's a few avenues that we're doing right now. Today I'm going to talk about ploidy manipulation, but I also want to let you know that we're working on hybridization within and between hydrangea species. We have a lot of dichroa hydrangea hybrids with nice blue flowers and compact form, but they currently don't have the foliar display of some of the larger mop heads, so we're still working on that avenue. We've also have the hydrangea reference genome developed, and we have done a genome-wide association, a series of genome-wide association studies that show we have three major loci for powdery mildew resistance, and so we will be following up with those genomic studies as well. I have a postdoc joining my lab here in a few weeks who will be taking on those projects. Today I'm going to talk about the ploidy manipulation work that we've done. Powdery mildew is one of the major diseases of hydrangea. It is caused by the pathogen Erysiphe polygony. It is an obligate biotroph. So if you have hydrangea macrophylla, you have powdery mildew if it's grown in an indoor or covered shade structure. There are other diseases of hydrangea. Cercospora leaf spot is a big one that affects the salability of hydrangea. It will not really kill the plant. It's usually something that appears later in the season and is just a sort of a nuisance. The root rot diseases are more prevalent on hydrangea, quercifolia, and other less water-loving species. You almost can't give hydrangea macrophylla a root rot because it loves water so much. So currently, hydrangea macrophylla cultivars are diploid or triploid. By far, the majority are diploid, so the ones you see in the landscape, the endless summers and the older reblooming varieties, they're mainly diploids. There are a couple of triploid cultivars. It is unknown in the origin whether there was a tetraploid at some point and it's been lost, or whether there's just a source of unreduced gametes that breeders had access to. It is likely that those triploids were selected just because they look different and interesting in a seedling pool, and that the breeders at the time did not know that, you know, there were ploidy differences. So in my research, when I'm looking at the influence of ploidy, a question I always ask is, how can I parse the influence of genotype versus ploidy level when you're comparing diploid and triploid cultivars? Because if I set the cultivar Taubay next to Endless Summer and I say, let's compare, I mean, they just have different genetic backgrounds. So my goal was to produce ploidy variation in plants of similar genetic backgrounds. Mutation breeding was not successful for me. I've produced some weird, wiggly, yellow, you know, spindly mutants, but nothing that either was good enough even for, like, evaluation testing, much less something that could eventually be, you know, a commercially successful product. So I turned to unreduced gamete breeding, which is using a source of 2N gametes as a parent in traditional breeding. And these unreduced gametes just arise from problems during meiosis. There are first reduction division problems, second reduction division problems. There's a whole myriad that could lead to unreduced gametes. And the way some of you have heard me say this, this is one of those great moments where you're doing routine lab work and stumble on something very cool. We just noticed that there were a lot of unreduced gametes in a certain cultivar. You can tell if you look at this histogram. The dark bars are the cultivar Aisha. You can see there's a single mode in the distribution of that pollen grain size. If you look at the pollen grain sizes of Trophy, it has a bimodal distribution where there's a mean around 8.9 micrometers and then another mean around 12.5 micrometers. And that bimodal distribution of pollen grain sizes is a pretty strong indicator that you have a large amount of unreduced gametes. So to test that idea, Trophy, this cultivar that makes unreduced gametes, was used in a series of reciprocal crosses with the cultivars Zahn Koenig, which is a lace cap, and Princess Juliana, which is a mop head. The objectives were to evaluate these reciprocal full sibling families for ploidy and ornamental traits, determine the impact of ploidy, and see if this is an efficient way to breed. So we made controlled crosses. Even though hydrangeas are pretty fairly outcrossing, we emasculate because, I don't know, that's how I was taught to do it. So we emasculate and bag. And we will pollinate a few days after emasculation. Seed generally takes 90 or 120 days to set. We'll pollinate in May or June and collect seed in October or November. We grew out the seedlings from all of the families and then did flow cytometry to check genome sizes on them. We did a lot of data analysis for the phenotypic traits in SAS. And we took, as you can see, just a variety of traits, things that we thought through the literature that ploidy might influence. So as you can see in this picture, just step over here. Trophy was our source of unreduced gametes. When Trophy was used as a female, all of our progeny was diploid. But when Trophy was used as a male, we had a lot of triploid progeny. 94% of the progeny was triploid from that cross with Trophy as a male, as opposed to zero when it was a female. So that confirmed our hypothesis that those giant pollen we were seeing were indeed unreduced gametes. So the triploids had larger and fewer inflorescences than diploids. We also have an aneuploid. It could be a potential tetraploid, but we would need to count chromosomes on that to be absolutely sure. That seems to be a bloom mutant with 56 inflorescences on it. And these were measured in 600, so 1.5-gallon pots. Triploids had the widest stems each year. They were 16% thicker than diploids, and their overall height was shorter. And so here's a picture of what they look like. You can see the stems are thinner on the diploids. The leaves are more elliptical. They're a lighter green. The triploids are much thicker, darker. You can see the stomata pattern where the triploids that are in the middle have a similar number of stomates, but they are larger. The aneuploid or potential tetraploid has many, many more stomata. So the triploid had fewer larger than diploid. And here's another picture of that where you can see the diploids on the far left. The triploids have larger stomates with more chloroplasts that surround them, and then the putative tetraploid has something that looks to me like a too many mouths mutation or something similar to almost the whole undersurface of the leaf is stomate. So ploidy has been shown, so we showed that it influenced these morphological traits, so now we decided to put them in disease resistance trials and see if any of these would influence powdery mildew. So what we did is we took six diploids and seven triploids from this full sibling family, and we placed in the greenhouse in a randomized complete block design with 6 replications. We let the disease naturally progress, because it always will if you're in a greenhouse with hydrangeas. We calculated disease severity using a scale of 0 to 100% foliage affected. And we also decided to try an app called Leaf Doctor that you can, is a smartphone-based app where you take a picture of the leaf and it shows, you know, it will tell you how it will sort of do the green-brown conversion and give you the percent of leaf that's affected. And we use the top 3 leaves per plant for that Leaf Doctor analysis. So as you can see here, triploid plants had a much lower severity of powdery mildew infection in all weeks of observation. By week 9, the scores were significantly lower for triploids than diploids, and triploids had significantly less foliar damage than diploids. So these that I picked in for the picture were sitting next to each other in the study. You can see the diploid on the top has pretty severe powdery mildew infection on the leaves, and its triploid full sibling on the bottom is uninfected. Well, one thing I also want to point out to you is we've done many generations of breeding using the cross Endless Summer times Vecchii, because Endless Summer is the industry standard, rebloomer. And Vecchii in previous studies has been shown to have some powdery mildew resistance. So we have done many crosses and a lot of selection from that. And on the far right, ES times V, is our most powdery mildew resistant selection from that breeding series. And I just put that in there to show the triploid, the first generation of triploids we made was just as resistant as this. These genetics we've been working with for many, many years. So it's definitely a promising avenue. And again, here's just a picture of the triploid on the left and the diploid on the right. Another thing that I want you to notice is this sort of corroborates some of the numerical data. Everything is larger. The leaves are larger, the stems are larger, the flowers are larger, and the flowers stay on. So I took this picture. So when were these talks due? July 18th? July 17th? And these plants had bloomed in May. So the diploid plants were long gone, like the flowers were long gone, melted away, deadheaded off. And you can see that the triploid flowers, are still on there. Some people like the look of the sort of aged hydrangea mop heads on the plant, and they do hold that look. So these are some of the raw data, and what I wanted to show you this to illustrate is that by week 9 of the study, some of the triploids had started to get a spot of powdery mildew. So right, you can see that one on the very far right column for the triploid. So because these are their full siblings are not resistant, I don't believe there's any genetic resistance involved. There's something mechanical happening with the penetration of the foliage by the pathogen. So it eventually will happen. Generally in production, especially propagation production, growers will spray for powdery mildew every 2 to 4 weeks. The good ones will rotate in like a neem oil or something to, you know, not spray so much of the bad stuff, but it is a constant rotational spray in indoor container production and propagation. So if that could just be, you know, cut back by 50% or 60%, even if it was not down to nothing, that would make a significant dent in the labor cost, the pesticide cost, and just the overall use of pesticides in the industry. So this research established a link between ploidy and disease resistance, and we are hypothesizing that the changes in plant form and stomatal density may lead to this increased disease resistance, and it might have implications for other abiotic and biotic traits. There's also other wide-ranging impacts of this, such as the ability to make, you know, your favorite hydrangea, a triploid, through this unreduced, you know, crossing with the source of unreduced gametes, and could be a bridge for breeding other hydrangea varieties that are hexaploid or have a 3X base number. And also the best ones of these that had really good flowering and really good powdery mildew resistance are under a nationwide multi-site evaluation with cooperators for potential release. So with that, there are lots of our Tennessee State University colleagues. Dr. Fulya Bicel-Gorell was the pathologist that worked on this project with us. And her lab tech, Terry Simmons, and my lab tech, Carrie Witcher, put in a significant amount of time for the flow cytometry and the powdery mildew observation. So with that, thank you for listening and for coming to this session. We have 15 minutes before the next group is in. So feel free to stick around. Thanks. Yes?
I'm really intrigued with the one that you said, the main fluid, possibly the tetra fluid. With that many, that's just a lot of stomata. And I'm intrigued that they're smaller, too, because everything we've seen in Acer and Cornus and Hibiscus and Prunus has all been, there's a negative relationship between fluid and stomata density. So as fluid goes up, size goes up, but
well, not only did it have many, many more stems, and each stem had a flower, it was like tiny. It was like this big, you know, pretty much full grown. We have been successful in crossing it with one or two things, but it's definitely weird. It also does not have showy sepals. It has lost that trait.
Some of your crosses, I know you make triploids immediately, which is awesome, but some of the diploids that came out of that, have you used those in any crosses or looked at the pollen of them to see if maybe that underused gamete trait has been transferred into any of the diploid projects?
He asked a very good question. To see, he said that 2N gamete formation can be heritable, and maybe the diploids in my population might have retained that trait from their parent that makes unreduced gametes. I haven't looked at that. We have looked at their pollen to look at fertility, like just standard, we're going to use them to cross, let's take a survey. Nothing really jumped out, but I will say we have just done a study where we put the parent, the source of unreduced gametes, and several of their offspring, both diploid and triploid, into heat and cold shock treatments to try to increase unreduced gamete production. So those we will be looking at hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and actually measure, you know, taking the measurements on the, with the micrometer. So if there's any, you know, small amount that we just wouldn't be able to see with the naked eye, just observing pollen, that will sort of be sussed out in that. But that's actually not something I thought of, so thank you. Anybody else? Yes.
I figured since
we
got 15 minutes. We do. We tried as a high throughput method for analyzing pollen for unreduced gametes, trying to do flow cytometry, and it's in the literature. But we have been unsuccessful in hibiscus, and maybe it's because they're you know, giant exon, and they've got distant threads, and so it's really challenging to get them to work. But I'm wondering if you guys investigated that as a method, because you've got a big population, right? And to get through all of those, you know, under the scope is a long time. So if you or if anybody else has optimized and actually gotten it to work, I'd love to hear about it.
Me too. You know, it's funny, like, I know that really getting into those protocols and getting systems like that in place is good, but then sometimes when you have access to, like, five or six undergrads, it's easier to just set them in front of the computer and have them count and look. Also, you know, what's interesting is most of the protocols that let you look at unreduced gametes and flow cytometry, it's not like you can, I don't know, recover the pollen at the end and use it or anything. So it's quite destructive, and you need a lot of pollen. The answer is no. I have not so far used our flow cytometer to look at the pollen grains themselves, but that is an avenue that we're looking at. Okay. Thank you again, everybody. Oh, Zanel.
Yeah. I'm looking for a new graduate student.
Anybody else? Grad students, postdocs? All right, Zanel, they're all yours. Okay, thanks again, everybody.